Celebrated author Felicia Gold, resident of Bedford and member of the Chi Theta Omega chapter of the Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated, is thrilled to announce the release of her debut cozy mystery novel, Texts, Tea, and Tragedy, the first in the captivating Bella Hawkins mystery series. Set in the quaint and charming town of Bedford, Texas, this cozy mystery promises readers a blend of suspense, heart, and hope. The novel is now available on Amazon and Kindle and will soon be in some bookstores and retailers. In Texts, Tea, and Tragedy, Bella Hawkins, an autistic English professor with a unique ability to perceive details others miss, relocates to Bedford after a turbulent breakup. As she settles into her new life, she quickly finds herself entangled in the town's deep-rooted mysteries. With her intuitive nature and sharp intellect, Bella must navigate the complexities of new friendships, old wounds, and the dark secrets that threaten the peace of this seemingly idyllic community. The novel's gripping plot unfolds as bodies start piling up, and Bella's determination to solve the mystery leads her to an unconventional friendship with Kumar, a misunderstood local artist. As Bella gets closer to uncovering the truth, she realizes that saving Kumar may come at a high price, unearthing the town's hidden secrets and facing the danger that lurks within. Felicia masterfully weaves a story that explores the themes of resilience, courage, and the enduring human spirit. Through Bella Hawkins, readers will experience the journey of a woman driven by hope, fighting to protect those she cares about while learning to heal her own heart. Felicia Gold is an acclaimed author known for her insightful and engaging storytelling. Her works often delve into the complexities of human relationships and the power of hope. With Texts, Tea, and Tragedy, she introduces a protagonist that readers will root for, admire, and relate to on many levels. Hello, campus cronies. Welcome back to Campus Crime Chronicles. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Turner, higher education professional and true crime addict. In every episode of this podcast, I take a deep dive into some sort of true crime that occurred on a school campus or a crime that's associated with a college or university in some way. For each episode, I rate the seriousness of the crime from 1 to 5 on my serious crime scale, with 1 being completely not serious, possibly even a little humorous from time to time, to 5 being very serious. Today's episode is rated a 5. In June 2017, Yingying Zhang, a 26-year-old PhD student and visiting scholar from China, vanished after being seen at a campus bus stop at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. What followed was a heartbreaking search, a chilling investigation, and a devastating truth, that Yingying Zhang was no longer alive. While a suspect was identified and convicted, Yingying's body has never been recovered, and her final resting place still remains a controversial mystery. This episode is titled, A Ride with a Stranger. So without further ado, let's get started. Was the kind of person who seemed both ordinary and extraordinary all at once. She grew up in a small town in China with her younger brother, Yang Yang, and her parents, Rong Guao and Li Feng. From a young age, Ying Ying stood out, not for being loud or attention-seeking, but for her quiet independence and unwavering dedication to her studies. She once told her mother, quote, "The more I study, the more passionate I am," end quote. Her mother, Li Feng, could only marvel at her daughter's determination, and she was often left without words by Yingying's relentless drive. So, when Yingying completed her degree at the prestigious Peking University in Beijing, it came as no surprise to her family, or her fiancé, Xiaolin, that she set her sights even higher, a PhD in the United States. In April of 2017, she took the next step toward that dream. Yingying arrived at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign as a visiting scholar, ready to begin her doctoral work in environmental sciences. She joined the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, one of the top programs in the country, and was full of hope for the future. Since she was a young girl, Yingying kept a personal diary about her life and innermost thoughts, and she wasted no time adding to that diary during her time in America. One of her first entries, dated April 30th, 2017, reads, "I've been in Illinois for a week. University of Illinois is very beautiful, kind of like Sun Yat-sen University. I fell in love with it at first glance. However, I'm feeling a little anxious. It's the first time I've lived independently. I feel a little bit lonely, but I still want to try. Pursuing a PhD requires a lot of hard work. The rule is simple. Live a simple life. Be effective." As you can gather, Yingying's diary entries paint a vivid picture of a young woman balancing two worlds. She was, of course, excited and full of hope about starting a new chapter in the United States. But also, she was nervous and unsure. It was the first time she'd ever lived on her own. And while she was determined to succeed, she wasn't afraid to admit that she also felt a little lonely. According to a 2020 documentary titled Finding Yingying, she moved into a small apartment in campus housing at the University of Illinois. During those first few weeks, she continued writing in her diary, capturing the emotional whirlwind of adjusting to life in a new country. Her entries were honest and vulnerable. They were introspective and full of wonder. But what was also evident was the quiet strain of pressure that she placed on herself to succeed. As a doctoral student, Yingying was passionate about environmental sciences, and she loved the research and the data and the purpose behind it all. On May 10th, 2017, she described a field trip she took with her friend and colleague at the university, Guofeng. They went to Nebraska for their first official fieldwork assignment. She wrote, "This is the first day of our trip to Nebraska, the first time for fieldwork. My colleague, Guofeng, and I departed at 3 p.m. The wide scenery, crop field at the highway, are quite attractive to me. The color of nature, blue sky, green grass, white houses, naturally amazing. By the way, the road was also special. Few cars and few people, only us. I have so many similarities with Guofeng. We like forests. We love freedom. We are idealists. We face difficulties head on. The difference is that I may compromise. I may want to be famous." That diary entry was a revealing moment. It showed not just the beauty she saw around her, but also how deeply she thought about her own identity and her ideals and her future. Yingying wasn't just chasing a degree. She was chasing something bigger, something much more meaningful. But her determination came with discipline and strict routines. She pushed herself hard, with every day mapped out like a mission. One of her final diary entries from 2017, dated June 1st, offers a glimpse into that relentless drive. She wrote, "Speaking English, morning reading, 20 minutes. Jogging, 30 minutes. 6 to 6:30. Study, 40 minutes. Breakfast, 20 minutes. March on." As you can see, she was focused, she had a plan, and she was moving full steam ahead. But all of that would come to a screeching halt just over a week later. On Friday, June 9th, 2017, Yingying Zhang vanished, and she would never be seen again. According to Yingying's two colleagues at the university, Guofeng and Yan, the day Yingying went missing was a normal Friday in the office. The three PhD students were preparing to pack up the damaged equipment from their fieldwork that week, and afterward, the three of them had plans to go out to dinner together. But around noon, Yingying mentioned she had to step out a little early. She needed to sign a new lease for her apartment, but she promised to be back soon. Hours passed, though, and when she still wasn't back by 5 p.m., Guofeng and Yan started feeling like something wasn't right. They tried calling Yingying, but she didn't answer. Concerned, they decided to swing by her apartment, but no one answered the door there either. So they kept calling her phone, but still no response. Both feeling overcome with worry, they knew they had to take action at that point. It was time to call the police. As police got to work trying to trace Yingying's last known movements, friends and colleagues at the University of Illinois notified her family back in China to give them the devastating news that Yingying had gone missing. Yingying's mother, Li Feng, was too overcome with grief and illness to make the trip, but her aunt, Li Qin, and her fiancé, Shaolin, wasted no time. Alongside Yingying's father, Rong Guao, they arrived in the U.S. just days after Yingying vanished, desperate for answers. From the moment they touched down, the Zhang family launched their own search mission, scouring the university and surrounding areas, hoping and praying that Yingying would be found safe and sound. In the Finding Yingying documentary, her father recalled how his daughter had always been the brightest light in their family. With sadness and despair in his voice, he said, quote unquote, "I'm an old man. If I lose Yingying, I lose everything." For Shaolin, the thought of losing Yingying cut especially deep. He spoke of the bond the two of them shared, their years as college classmates in China, the plans they'd made to marry after his graduation. He said, quote, "She will be a really good scientist, a big shot. We've been together for 8 years. For me, she is a companion, but also a role model," end quote. However, in this moment, Shaolin's love was laced with fear and worry, and deep down, he knew something was horribly wrong. He said, quote, "I have a really bad feeling because I know Yingying. She would not go somewhere alone without telling family members or friends," end quote. Meanwhile, back to the police, they were racing against the clock to find some answers. After thoroughly searching Yingying's apartment for some sort of clues as to where she might be, investigators began combing through airports and hospitals and jails, all in search of any sign of the missing graduate student. However, they continually hit dead ends and could not locate her anywhere. But finally, they got a lead. Detective Eric Stiverson with the University Police Department explained, quote, "We knew that she was supposed to go to an apartment complex to sign a lease, and she would have needed to take a bus. So we were able to locate the security video of her getting on the bus near where she lived. That was a big step in the case. She got off that bus, and she was supposed to get on another bus, which was going to take her to sign the lease. And she missed her bus. We have over 2,000 cameras on campus, and it was a telecommunicator working the midnight shift who noticed what he believed was her standing near a bus stop. At that point, it quickly went from a missing person to a possible kidnapping," end quote. You see, at this second bus stop, Yingying could be seen getting into a four-door black sedan, more specifically, a Saturn Astra. And after this, all boots were on the ground. The search for Yingying then expanded across state lines into Indiana, and the FBI got involved too, even offering up a $10,000 reward for information about her whereabouts and potential kidnapping. Anthony Manganiello, a supervisory special agent for the FBI, said they combed through as much surveillance video as possible, all eyes on that black Saturn Astra. As they meticulously went through hours of video footage, they realized that the front passenger hubcap of the vehicle they were looking for was broken or cracked. This piece of information then led them to an unlikely suspect, a former teaching assistant at the university and PhD student in the physics department, 28-year-old Brent Christensen. Manganiello explained, quote, "Agents discovered that a black Saturn Astra registered to Brent Christensen had that same cracked hubcap. We go to Christensen's house with that search warrant to seize that vehicle and try to talk to him. We asked him about his whereabouts on the day of June 9th, 2017, end quote. As revealed in the Finding Yingying documentary, law enforcement sat down with Christensen and officially interviewed him on June 15th, 6 days after Yingying went missing. When they asked him where he was on Friday, June 9th, he told them that he was either playing video games at his apartment, alone, or he might have been taking an afternoon nap. Then, when they asked Christensen if he knew why they brought him into the station for questioning, he responded by saying that it was because the car he owns was seen picking up a girl who was missing. Law enforcement pressed Christensen further, and they flat out told him that they knew he picked up Yingying at the bus stop, that it was him who did it on that Friday. So, he went on to say that perhaps he was getting his days mixed up. He said, quote, "I thought I drove around on Saturday. I did pick a girl up. I don't remember where. I saw her picture. I don't think it was her, though," end quote. Then, Christensen said he didn't remember the girl's name, but he did remember that she was speaking broken English. He said he saw her and she looked very distressed. So, he said, he gave her a short ride, maybe a couple of blocks, but that was it. He said, quote, She freaked out and got out, and that was the last I saw of her," end quote. Needless to say, police knew he was lying. I mean, they had surveillance footage that proved it. Manganiello said, quote, "After that interview, he was our primary suspect. Ultimately, forensic evidence found in Christensen's apartment and numerous covert recordings conducted over the next couple of weeks gave us the evidence we needed to arrest Christensen," end quote. According to the Finding Ying Ying documentary, law enforcement watched Christensen's every move for the next 2 weeks after his interview, and part of their surveillance included someone who secretly worked with the police and the FBI, a young woman named Tara Bullis. Now, remember those covert recordings mentioned by Manganiello? Well, Tara is the one who helped the FBI secure the recordings. You see, apparently, Christensen was married to a woman named Michelle, but he and Michelle allegedly had an open relationship or an open marriage, meaning Christensen also had a girlfriend, and that girlfriend was Tara Bullis. When the FBI discovered this information, they approached Tara, who agreed to secretly record her conversations with Christensen. Tara explained, quote, "That's been something very difficult for me. People would say, oh, the FBI forced her, or they manipulated her, or maybe they were paying me to do this. When they said, we think somebody close to you might be involved, from the beginning, it was me who said, is there a way I can help? And I felt like that the whole time, even when it was scary. And it was," end quote. So for 2 weeks, Tara recorded her interactions and conversations with Christensen. Then on June 29th, the University of Illinois held a vigil, a benefit walk, and a concert to raise awareness about Ying Ying's disappearance, all of which was attended by not only Ying Ying's father, an aunt and fiance, and hundreds of other students, but also by Christensen himself. And he asked Tara to go with him. At the vigil, as participants were lining up to begin the benefit walk in honor of Ying Ying, Tara met Christensen and the two lined up with the crowd for the walk. As they were marching, Christensen was not only drinking alcohol, but he also said something that sent chills down Tara's spine. He told her, quote, "These people are here for me," end quote. Then he went on to say that a lot more people showed up than he anticipated. He said he only expected maybe 50 people rather than the hundreds that actually attended the benefit. At the conclusion of the walk, Tara asked Christensen if he planned to go to the concert later that day as well, and he said yes, because, well, that was also for him. If you are completely disgusted right now, you're not alone. Anyway, then before they left, Christensen made a terrifying confession to Tara. In her own words, she explained, quote, "When we came back here, he took my phone and opened the notepad. And he said, it was me. He showed me, and then he erased it and said, she was number 13. And he showed me. He erased it. And then he said, she is gone. And then he showed me, and then he erased it. And then he just typed the word forever. I had to sit through the whole concert after having seen that, knowing that I was sitting next to the person who was responsible," end quote. But wait, that's not all. Brace yourselves because it gets worse. Tara went on to say, quote, "And even while we were sitting in the concert, there were some young ladies in front of us. And he said, we should follow them after the concert. They would be a good choice for someone to do that again. I was terrified because I realized that I had more hours with this man, but also that this is someone's daughter. This is someone's sister. This is someone's girlfriend. And I'm someone's daughter. I'm someone's sister. I'm someone's girlfriend. And if it were me, I would want people to try and help. So I wanted to find her too. And if he felt comfortable talking to me, I just had to keep going. And I had to pretend nothing was wrong," end quote. By now, law enforcement had enough evidence to arrest Christensen, and he was officially arraigned on July 3, 2017, as a large crowd gathered outside of the courthouse, shouting and chanting, "Justice for Ying Ying." And this was the first time Ying Ying's family came face to face with Brent Christensen. Her father watched him closely, hoping for a confession. Frustrated and heartbroken, Ying Ying's father explained, quote, "When I saw the suspect, I thought he would confess or something, but he didn't admit anything and said nothing. So I was very angry," end quote. Okay, so before we get too much further along, I do want to inform y'all that while the authorities were making their case against Christensen to arrest him, they also looked into his statement to Tara Bullis that Ying Ying was the 13th person he'd kidnapped and killed. However, they found no evidence whatsoever that that statement was true. For whatever reason, he was just talking and boasting. Probably even a little bit of drunk talk because he was drinking. But regardless, authorities firmly believed he was lying and that Ying Ying was his first and only victim. So, anyway, moving on. Shortly after the arraignment, police called the Zhang family to the station to deliver the news they had feared since the day they arrived in the U.S. Authorities now believed Ying Ying was no longer alive. Xiaolin, Ying Ying's fiancé, struggled to process the devastating update. He said, quote, "On one hand, I feel lost. On the other hand, I'm still hopeful because the FBI used the word believe. Maybe they made a mistake. There's still hope," end quote. And Ying Ying's family clung tightly to that glimmer of hope. Her aunt, Li Qin, echoed that sentiment. She said, quote, "Everyone, including me, still thinks she's alive. She's just somewhere," end quote. On July 20th, 2017, 41 days after Ying Ying vanished, Christensen appeared in court for his official plea hearing. His plea? Not guilty to kidnapping. And that meant the prosecution now had to prepare for a full-scale trial. The challenge for prosecutors, however, was that Christensen wasn't admitting to anything, not kidnapping and certainly not murder, even though investigators were convinced that's exactly what happened. So now they faced the daunting task of building a case without a body, one of the toughest to prove in court. And as many of you know, the wheels of justice in the U.S. turn painfully slow. While this is meant to ensure fairness, it can leave victims and families waiting months or even years for answers. And it was no different for the Zhang family. Over a year later, the family still had no answers and the trial was delayed. Ying Ying's fiancé, Xiaolin, explained some of the nuances between the U.S. and Chinese justice systems. He said, quote, "China and the U.S. have a lot of differences between their criminal justice systems. Here, even if police know for sure that the suspect did it, they have no way to make him talk. But in China, it's different. The police have the right and the methods to interrogate him and make him tell the truth," end quote. The trial for Christensen, now 30 years old, wouldn't begin until June 12, 2019, over 2 years after Ying Ying's disappearance. Both Ying Ying's family and the prosecution were confident that they could secure a conviction, but what they weren't confident about was whether or not Christensen would get life in prison or be sentenced to death for the kidnapping of Ying Ying Zhang, resulting in her death, which was the focus of the trial. The thing is, though, the defense dropped a bombshell of an opening statement that shocked everyone in the courtroom. Even the media described it as a rare Perry Mason moment. Rob Kronk, the jury foreman for the trial, explained, quote, "The defense, very shockingly, admitted that Brent Christensen had committed the crime. But for them, it wasn't about the guilt of Brent Christensen. It was about the death penalty," end quote. Yeah, you heard that right. The prosecution had so much evidence against Christensen, including their star witness, Tara Bullis, to whom he had confessed the crime, that the defense straight up admitted that Christensen kidnapped and killed Ying Ying. Steve Beckett, the Zhang family attorney, said he and the Zhangs had discussed nearly every possible scenario that could play out in court prior to the trial. But when the defense came out and openly admitted that Christensen was guilty of the crime, Beckett was flabbergasted. He said, quote, "I was surprised. In 46 years, I had never seen that before," end quote. During the trial, though, the terrifying details of the crime were finally revealed. And for the first time since Ying Ying's disappearance, the Zhang family learned what prosecutors believe happened to Ying Ying. On June 9th, 2017, Christensen was driving around campus looking for a victim. He first spotted a student that morning, but she refused to get into his car, and that student even called campus police to report the suspicious guy who offered her a ride. Then, later in the afternoon, Christensen noticed Ying Ying standing by herself at the bus stop. He pretended to be a police officer, so Ying Ying felt safe enough to get into his car. But instead of taking her where she needed to go, to sign a lease for an apartment, he drove her back to his own apartment and forced her inside. In his bedroom, he tortured Ying Ying and sexually assaulted her before carrying her to the bathroom and placing her into his bathtub. He then proceeded to smash her head with a baseball bat. But, according to prosecutors, she didn't die from the devastating blow. So he then used a knife and proceeded to stab her in the neck. Y'all, prosecutors believe that Christensen stabbed her so many times that he actually decapitated Ying Ying before ultimately disposing of her body. I know, it's just horrific and extremely hard to hear. So you can only imagine how distraught and devastated Ying Ying's family was after hearing such horrendous details of the crime. At the conclusion of the trial, the jury deliberated for only about 2 hours before coming back with a verdict. They found Christensen guilty on all counts, particularly kidnapping resulting in the death of Ying Ying Zhang. Now, the penalty phase of the trial wouldn't come until a little later, but outside the courthouse, at the conclusion of the verdict, Ying Ying's father read a statement. He said, in part, quote, "I thank the jury for this step toward justice. We hope and believe that this trial will eventually bring justice to Ying Ying and us. Our wish has always been to find Ying Ying and bring her home. We will not give up," end quote. When it was time for the penalty phase of the trial, Christensen's defense team made a case to avoid the death penalty, and their strategy included shifting part of the blame for his actions to the university itself. You see, on March 21st, 2017, a solid 80 days before the kidnapping and murder, Christensen visited the counseling center on campus, and he disclosed some disturbing information. He told the counselor that he had accessed a huge online forum about serial killers, and he said he started having ideations of murdering someone. When the counselor asked him just how intense those ideations were, he revealed that he had gone so far as to make plans to kill someone. He went on to say that he even began purchasing items related to his plans. Additionally, in that counseling session, he said he had not yet identified a specific victim or a person to murder, but he admitted that there was a certain type that he had in mind. What? Okay, so I know when I learned that extra piece of information, I had some concerns regarding the university. So you can probably imagine that this did have an effect on the jury too, as they were considering his sentence. I mean, even Ying Ying's loved ones had some valid concerns upon learning this new information. Her fiancé, Shaolin, said, quote, "I think the university should have at least told us. Perhaps they were worried they would have to take responsibility. They knew the suspect was dangerous, but they didn't report it. To some extent, what they did allowed things to happen," end quote. According to jury foreman Rob Kronk, the jury members took a confidential vote first, and then they went around the table and openly discussed the two options. Kronk said, quote, "Some people were very convinced one way and the other way. I was basically on the fence. Ultimately, I felt that there was no remorse exhibited by the defendant, and I believed that he was telling the truth that she went crazy after she realized that he was not going to the One North Apartments. And he could have made a different choice at that point in time. He could have seen her as a person as she fought for her life. That was another reason for choosing the death penalty over life in prison," end quote. But alas, the jury was split. After 8.5 hours of deliberation, the jury was unable to reach a unanimous decision. 10 voted for the death penalty, and 2 voted for life in prison. That meant the judge presiding over the trial had no choice but to hand down a punishment of life in prison without the possibility of parole. The only silver lining for the Zhang family was that Brent Christensen would never walk away a free man again. But they were still disappointed. After the sentencing was announced, Shaolin spoke to the media, saying, quote, "For me, for myself, the result today seems to tell me that I can kill anyone, and that I can kill anyone with all kinds of cruel measures, and I will not need to die for it. And me, myself, will never agree with that," end quote. As for Ying Ying's family, well, they just wanted to know where she was, where her final resting place was. Because, you see, what exactly Christensen did with Ying Ying's body after kidnapping and killing her was never revealed. At least, it wasn't revealed publicly, not even to the Zhang family, until after the trial and sentencing. And even then, they were skeptical at best. According to multiple sources, that's because the information regarding his disposal of Ying Ying's body was part of an immunity agreement, meaning those details couldn't be released or used during trial. At a press conference on August 7, 2019, after his trial was over, the Zhang family and the general public learned what likely happened to Yingying after she took her last breath. The Zhang's attorney, Steve Beckett, announced the following. Quote, after killing Yingying Zhang, Christensen placed her bodily remains into garbage bags. He placed those garbage bags in the dumpster immediately outside his apartment building. The contents of the dumpster were taken to a private landfill. It was determined that by the time Christensen's attorneys disclosed his statements to the federal authorities, the contents of the dumpster that contained Yingying's remains would have been covered by at least 30 feet of fill. It's evident that any attempt to recover Yingying's remains would be complicated and expensive. To date, no search has been undertaken, but the Zhang family understands that the authorities are still considering an attempt to locate and recover Yingying's remains. End quote. According to the reporting of Jeff Truesdell for People.com, at that same news conference, Yingying's father, Ren Guo, spoke on behalf of the family and responded to the heartbreaking news of their daughter's remains. He said, quote, if what that man said is true, it further confirms that he is a heartless and evil person. We condemn his brutal and malicious actions, and we hope that he suffers the rest of his life as he made Yingying suffer in the final moments of her life. We now understand that finding Yingying may be impossible. End quote. Ultimately, the Zhang family had no choice but to return to China without their precious Yingying. But before they left, the family decided to follow Chinese custom, and they created a gravesite for Yingying in the U.S., on the campus of U of I. They said they hope it will be a solemn place of reflection, as well as a place to remember the joy Yingying brought to not only her family, but also to everyone she met during her life. Now, I do want to share with you that the Zhang family filed a lawsuit against the University of Illinois for negligence, specifically naming counseling center employees. WTTS, a Chicago PBS station, reported that the lawsuit accused two employees of acting with deliberate indifference toward warning signs that Christensen exhibited during his visit to the counseling center. If they were to win the suit, the family planned to use the money to search for Yingying's remains. However, in December 2019, a federal judge dismissed the lawsuit. You see, the lawsuit shed light on the actions and processes that the counseling center employees did take, and a judge ruled that they did not create or heighten a specific danger to Yingying. ABC News reported that Christensen initially met with an intern at the counseling center to whom he disclosed his homicidal ideations. That intern, incredibly concerned with what he told her, suggested that he undergo an official assessment, and she also connected him with one of the specialized counselors, as well as discussed his case with other staff, two of whom met with Christensen. One of those specialized counselors noted that there was no need for hospitalization at the time because Christensen stated he had no current suicidal or homicidal plans or intents. He was scheduled to return for another visit, but he never showed up or followed through with his care plan. WTTS reported that in his dismissal of the lawsuit, U.S. District Court Judge Colin Bruce acknowledged the devastating nature of the case, but he stated it was speculative to claim that the staff's alleged failure to follow a treatment plan increased the danger to Yingying. Judge Bruce wrote, quote, defendants did not change a safe situation into a dangerous one. The situation with Christensen was already dangerous and would remain so. End quote. Which, to me, is just a grim reminder of how pervasive the threat was all along. Okay, so, side note. I want to take a quick moment to step back and address something that really hits close to home for me as someone who works in higher education. Cases like this are a haunting reminder of why it is absolutely critical for colleges and universities to have clear, detailed protocols and guidelines in place. Not only to support students, but also to protect the institution and employees themselves. And when I first heard that the university had information about Brent Christensen that could have raised red flags, I was definitely concerned. But when the full story came to light, that they did set up a treatment plan, that they did follow their procedures, I felt a sense of relief for the institution and the counseling center, because they did what they could, and a judge agreed. But here's the thing. Just like law enforcement can't prevent every crime, even the most well-prepared university can't prevent every tragedy. It's a harsh reality, but it's one we can't ignore. Okay, so anyway, moving on again. I'd like to end this episode on a positive note about Yingying Zhang, a bright, shining soul who was described as smart, beautiful, and kind. In August of 2019, a permanent endowment called Yingying's Fund was established in her honor through the University of Illinois Foundation. The fund was specifically established to support international students and their families in times of crisis. Her father, Rong Guao, read a statement in Mandarin at the dedication of the endowment, and he expressed how grateful he was for the help from so many people when they arrived in the U.S., and he wants other families to feel just as supported as they did. He said, quote, "Champaign is 7,000 miles away from our home. We didn't know who and where to ask for help. Then, when we arrived, there were so many people from the university and local community who helped us. If it was not for the kindness of these individuals, I cannot imagine how we would have been able to face all these challenges. However, we know there will be other international students and families facing hardship and loss when they are far away from home. It is our hope that this fund will offer some support and help when they are dealing with an accidental and urgent situation." End quote. The Zhang family made the initial donation to establish the fund, and since then, it has had nearly 600 donors and has raised over $68,000. If you would like to donate to Yingying's fund, I have included a direct link in the show notes, or you can visit illinois.edu and search Yingying's fund. Okay, y'all, that officially brings us to the end of Chronicle 97. As always, be sure to check out my social media where I post photos associated with each case and episode. You can find me at Campus Crime Chronicles on both Facebook and Instagram. Also, if you are enjoying what you hear, then I encourage you to go leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Those reviews truly help other listeners like you know this podcast is out there. Okay, well, that's all for today, so bye for now. Campus Crime Chronicles is researched, written, and recorded by me, Nicole Turner, and it's edited and produced by Giari Gassaway. Campus crony Alexis McDonald is my research assistant. Tune in again in 2 weeks for the next Chronicle.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.